It's still summer, even though the weather feels like fall. But teachers are already getting ready to start the school year, and some students have actually been scheming their back-to-school plans all summer long. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're starting today's show on KCUR's Central Standard with a student who spent the summer devising a campaign strategy. Luciana DeAnda will be starting her freshman year at Olathe East this year. She wants to be a leader, and she went to Madam President Camp this summer, where they mentor girls who want to run for class office. Hi, Luciana.
Hi.
What did you do at Camp Madam President? Can you describe, like, a typical day in the program?
Well, we might do some team building activities, or we get to know other people, basically. Or, for example, we learn to meditate so that we stay calm. For example, I did that this morning.
Before going on the radio?
Yeah.
So what were some of the meditation techniques that you think are really helpful for someone doing, like, high pressure work?
Well, you have to focus on one thing and make sure you're brain doesn't drift off to thinking about homework or work or whatever you do. You know, just think about a sound or a feeling in your body.
And that helps you stay calm, like before, say, a campaign speech.
Yeah.
What made you want to do this with your summer?
Well, my parents are very politically active, so I thought that this would be really fun. And then it also inspired me to go do a civic leadership academy at my school.
You know, I'm curious about your interest in politics and civic life. Do you remember what very first got you thinking politics and leadership, these are things I'm interested in and want to do, maybe should do?
Well, I paged once for Senator Sykes, and I went to Topeka to page, and I noticed that there were very few women there. There was probably at least 95% of the people there were men. And, you know, 95% of Kansas isn't men, right? So we need a fair representation of women's opinions, too. So I thought that being a leader is really important, even for women and men. But when women also need a fair representation.
How old were you when you did this and had this great epiphany?
Well, I actually did this, I think, this March. But I did it with a couple other girls, and that was really fun because I knew them, and I became really better friends with them, too.
So what are your big goals as a leader?
Well, some of my friends do want to be president, but I think that Madam President Camp definitely goes into other jobs and careers, and I definitely would like to be a journalist someday. And, you know, it teaches the Madam President Camp also teaches you to see both sides of the conversation, both sides of an opinion. And I really would like to explore that.
How do you think, I mean, this is a camp specifically geared toward young women, and I'm curious how being a girl figures into your ideas of what you want to do, what you can do, what you think it's important to do?
Well, I think that people may think that girls don't have as much of a advantage in some jobs, I guess. I think that now we're realizing that women can do anything that men can do.
That's your feeling about it?
Yeah, I definitely think that women can do anything that men can do, and that politics isn't just for men to do.
You have some real experience leading and organizing people, kids your own age.
Yeah, I led the walkout in April. And
relating to gun laws and things
yeah.
like that.
So it was to spread awareness of gun violence and to be part of something bigger. You know, everybody there, most of the people there were inspired because you're doing something that tons of other schools were doing all across the nation. And you're part of something big.
What motivated you on that issue and to just get really active about it?
I definitely think the Parkland shooting was something big that happened that kind of changed a lot of our minds. And, you know, as a student in a school, it's kind of scary going there every day. And, you know, a lot of people go to school to get away from some things back at home, but it's hard to do that when maybe you don't feel so safe.
And what were some first steps you took going from having your own private reaction to something that happened in the news to taking action and getting other students organized?
I definitely think Madam President Camp helped with that because I did it 2 years. And the first year I went, you know, you see other girls who are interested and they inspire you too. You don't just learn from the teachers, you learn from the kids there too. And, you know, they're amazing. And I still keep in touch with a lot of those girls. And for the walkout, a lot of my friends believe the same thing as I did. And we wanted to do something because you can make an impact, whether you're a politician or just a citizen or an eighth grader.
What was the very first thing you did?
To do the walkout?
Yeah. I'm guessing you saw a news item by yourself. You either read it or maybe your parents told you about it. What was the first step you took going from having your own thoughts about it to getting other people involved?
Well, I kind of thought of doing the walkout because just to speak out, but I wasn't sure if my school would let me do a walkout because I was hearing a lot about how like threats of suspension or just the consequences of it all. But when we talked to our principal, he understood and he told us we could do a walkout. And I definitely think my friends inspired me too.
Let's get back to this camp. Was there something you did that made a real impression on you that you think will either help you as you run for class office maybe in high school or even for real office later on or as a journalist later on?
Yeah. Well, we did 2 years ago, I did a speech and they taught us all the methods of being calm while preparing a speech and performing in front of other people. And it's mostly about being thoughtful of what you're saying and being calm, because nothing good happens from being from lashing out or doing anything like that. So,
and do I understand that this summer you went on field trips to Jeff City and Truman Library? Did anything you saw on those field trips feel like something that anyone being civically engaged in this country should really be thinking about or aware of?
Well, when we went to the Truman Library, we were assigned roles to, assigned roles of actual people who worked at the White House around the time after World War II. So everybody was assigned basically a different opinion. You throw your own opinions away for a second and you think about this person's opinions and you make a speech and you prepare and it kind of helps you see both sides, because I got this guy named Kenneth Royale and we were talking about desegregation in the Army, and he didn't believe that there should be desegregation in the Army. So you had to argue that point. And really a big problem in today's world is that we don't see both sides and that we may not compromise, which we worked on a lot, was compromising with other people and negotiating, because you can't get one side or the other. You have to make both sides happy.
So it sounds like you had to imagine. It sounds like you had to imagine a point of view that was very much not yours.
Yeah, exactly.
Was that hard?
It was very hard, especially since, you know, you may think, because speaking the opinion of somebody that you agree with, you can add in your own opinion and everything, and you have to argue for something that you're passionate for. But then I had to argue why desegregation was bad, and I didn't agree with that at all, so I had to really think through other people's eyes.
Did you learn something through doing that you don't think you understood just thinking about segregation and desegregation before?
I think I learned that people have their opinions and you can't always change them, so it's kind of, I guess I kind of learned to see things through another point of view, and I definitely got some weird looks after saying all these things in the speech, because I was saying that, like, basically that we shouldn't be treated equally, but yeah, you see things from a different point of view.
When you said earlier that your parents were really politically active and that that's part of what inspired you, can you talk to me about that, like the role of politics and civic life in your existence so far?
Well, my parents definitely taught me that you can still make a difference as a citizen, because my mom, she does a lot of, she goes to a lot of protests, and I'm actually part of the Students Demand Action. And so we help people register to vote, and right now I'm learning how to be on a text training team. And I don't know much about that right now, but I will soon. And you're just being part of the community. And my parents definitely taught me that you don't have to be in politics to make a difference. You can start in your community.
You know, you're about to start your freshman year. Do you think that you will run for office?
Yeah, I definitely think student council, like the student council, really interests me. I just have to learn a little bit about preparing, and because I'm not sure what you have to do for that, but I'm definitely interested in it.
Do you think that, you know, like, I know a lot of girls your age, we're talking about Camp Madam President, you're going into your freshman year in high school, you're not even old enough to vote, and you've been helping other people get registered to vote.
Yeah.
There is a mentorship piece of what you've been doing, and I wonder what it's like to have a grown-up who's a role model, who isn't a parent or a teacher or someone like that. This isn't someone who's going to tell you what to do. This isn't someone who's going to grade you. This is just a person you can talk to with questions about what life is like out there and seeing a different example than your parents, than your teachers. What has that been like for you?
Well, I noticed when I was doing the second Madam President camp that I did, there were only about 4 girls total. And Julie, my teacher or my counselor, she helped us a lot with meditation and mediation. And we meditated so much during the day that she told us that she actually became nicer. Like, she felt herself more calm and she felt more aware of other people. And she said that it really, really helps. And we did it every day, most of the day. We even fell asleep a couple of times, I'm sure. But it's a really good method of just becoming nicer, not just being calm. It's your personality too, brings the best out of you.
Do you think that you'll use that when you start in a new school? Because that can be pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to get up early and just meditate for a while before going off to a really big high school and new people and all that.
So you're not sure yet how it works to run for class office there. Mm-hmm. Something I'm kind of curious about, is it cool to run for office these days? I am old. I have no idea.
I'm sure it's stressful. It's definitely nerve-wracking. Even just doing a speech, it's your heart's racing the whole time, but it's mostly the feeling you get at the end that after talking and doing well, you look back and, you know, some people may agree with you, some people may not, but I think it's the whole rush of excitement.
Well, Luciana DeAnda, have a great rest of your summer and good luck at Olathe East.
Thank you.
Luciana spent her summer at Madam President Camp, where she's in training to be a civically engaged person who might run for office in school or later in life. Up next, an engineering professor who spent the summer in South Africa working on a drainage issue that's been interfering with clean water. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're hearing stories now from teachers who spent their summers in surprising ways. Our next guest makes my summer feel pretty wimpy. John Kevern is with us from UMKC's Engineering School. He's in the Department of Civil and Mechanical Engineering, and he spent his summer in Cape Town, South Africa, dealing with a problem they're having with acid mine drainage. I will let him explain that. John Kevern, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So we are going to get details later on, but for now, just give us the short explanation of what you did in South Africa. You were working with grad students there to figure out how to keep runoff from mines from polluting the water supply.
Yeah, so we're anywhere that we've got mining, we oftentimes have mining pollution. and especially in areas without, we would say, the government controls like we have in the United States, many of these mines are abandoned, and the water that goes in the mines, the rainwater and groundwater, typically gets polluted. So we're helping them clean the water.
This is part of an exchange UMKC does, right?
So UMKC and the UM system in general, back in the 1980s, 85, there were quite a bit of protests on campus to divest in basically apartheid era South Africa. And so the UM system, in a very good stroke of wisdom at the time, said, that's great, we will divest, but what would really help them is if we had some intellectual exchange. And they set up the UM South Africa Exchange Program, and it sends faculty both directions, both from Cape Town in South Africa to the UM systems, but vice versa. And there's been hundreds of faculty that have gone over the years.
So what are some of the other projects that you know of that UMKC professors have taken on as part of this exchange?
So UMKC professors have anything from looking at mosquitoes and transmission rates of various viruses to astronomy. So they're the largest planetary observatory in the southern hemispheres in South Africa. So we've done that lately we've done a lot of water treatment.
And you personally have done other international engineering projects, right?
Yeah. So we work with the government of Ghana, which is in kind of northern Africa, to take a lot of their agricultural waste, and we burn them to make low-cost cement for building homes.
And when you say we, are you talking about the faculty at UMKC, the engineering school?
I would say me, and we partner with the government of Ghana. So they've actually sent researchers to UMKC that have brought lots of their agricultural waste, so palm kernel shells and corn husks and things in tow. We've burned them. We've designed this material, and we've implemented that in Ghana, in various points in Ghana.
And anything else?
We're currently working in Kenya, and we're optimizing in Kenya. You've got many different construction techniques, but a lot of the construction is just soil and cement to make soil blocks. So we're optimizing soil block construction, and we're also...
How do you do that? How do you optimize soil block construction?
Okay, optimizing soil block construction, we look at the chemistry of the soils and can do different mixes. So it's a lot like cooking, where you can take the same ingredients, and in different combinations, you get different flavors of cookies. You can get different flavors of soil blocks, so you can get different strengths or different durability performance. And really, for them, we're looking at doing it at as low a cost as possible, so they can do as much construction is for their money.
So what motivated you to get involved specifically on the issue of water pollution from mines around Cape Town, South Africa?
So access to consistent and clean water has been and always will be the largest daily challenge for most people on the planet. I've spent most of my career designing concrete that water flows through. I've done this we've got parking lots all over town, done this for many years. And about 6 years ago, we started optimizing that for pollution treatment. So actually turning the concrete into a giant Brita filter.
Whoa.
And so so we have this concrete that we've worked on pollution treatment. And I was in South Africa last summer talking about other waste materials incorporated into concrete, ran into a professor there that was doing some water treatment work, and we are on the same page. So I went and visited this summer.
Is there a larger issue that you are passionate about that drives all of these different projects?
What I'm passionate about is making a difference. And that is, if we look at the environment, we have more and more people putting a larger stress on the environment, which means we in the United States, most of us in the United States are fairly well off. And oftentimes we forget that a majority of the world would like to do better, just they don't have circumstances that allow them to make more money or have a healthier environment. And much like in many parts of South Africa, they have the will. They just need some technology transfer. So we can go, we don't have to provide much money, we just provide information and help.
So, I mean, there are, someone might push back and say there are communities here at home that have huge infrastructure needs, that have, you know, a lot of unmet needs. Do you ever think about applying some of these things domestically?
Yes, and we do it domestically, and we can't forget that in the United States, we have quite a large divide as well, and we definitely need to improve our infrastructure, and that is water treatment and sanitation, and we do need to advocate for the money to flow equally for all aspects of the U.S. society as well.
So let's get back to what you did this summer. What's the role of mining in South African culture and in the economy there?
So South Africa is an interesting geopolitical state. They've always had, from the Dutch East India Company to the British to the Dutch, we've had lots of colonialism there, and they are a mine or a mineral rich country. So there's uranium and diamonds and gold and coal and lots of rare earth metals, and so there are mines all over South Africa. I was specifically looking at mines on the east side of the country. That's where a lot of the coal mines and the coal production is, except we were based out of Cape Town, which is on the western side. So any summer wouldn't be great without a good road trip. And so I took one of the students, and we did a road trip across South Africa to go visit the mines and pick up materials and drive back. And so now I can say I've done about 4,000 miles across the heart of South Africa.
You know, when I think about just the United States, a lot of the places where you would find mining happening would not also usually be like, you know, a lot of the university research happens in major cities where the mining isn't happening. So the dynamic you're describing in that sense seems pretty similar. Was the student you worked with, had that student actually gone to see these mines before?
The student had seen the mines before. He was in South Africa as a refugee status from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So he had flown to visit the mines on a couple other occasions, but had never actually driven across the country. And so that student, we would drive across the country. He'd really never driven that far. And we had to got more than a few pictures where we'd stop in the middle of the road and get out and take pictures of the mountains.
What was that like? I mean, what was that like for you and, to the best of your knowledge, for him?
I thought it was fantastic. I love a good road trip, and a good road trip across Africa is even better. We took a little detour to the Big Hole, and so in the middle of South Africa in Kimberley, so you've probably heard of the De Beers diamond conglomerate, and so that came from the De Beers farm. It's a giant hand-dug hole, sort of a good rest stop, and we stopped. We stopped at little holes in the wall, and it was interesting enough, and I got to know him enough that he's applied to come get his PhD at UMKC, and so he'll be here in January.
Cool. Well, so as you took this road trip and saw things with your own eyes, like how these mines worked, I'm guessing you met some people who worked there?
So many of the mines we were dealing with were abandoned.
Ah.
And so it's fairly unfortunate in that the mines— you have informal settlements that have grown up around the mines. For when they were open, that's where the really lower paid workers lived. And so the people we met near the mines or the mouths of the mines, it was quite unfortunate in that the water is very polluted there, heavy metals and things. And you've got people washing clothes in that water, and you have little kids playing in that water. And so it really, if we could do something to help treat it, it goes a long way for helping those that can't help themselves.
Did that experience, did what you saw, did that help you take steps towards solving the problem of pollution from mines in a way that you might not have thought of had you not been able to witness how people are living in these areas, for example?
Well, it gives some motivation. So the chemistry and the physics of it are the same, whether we're doing it in the basement at UMKC or we're doing it out in the field. It's the scope of the problem is what is really mind-blowing. When you see how much pollution and how impoverished people are, you come back with motivation to do more, or to think bigger.
Can you give us an example of something you saw that's going to provide you with motivation for a long time?
Probably the most striking thing is watching a one-year-old or a two-year-old play in mine water that has a pH of about 2. And I would say they're more accustomed to it than we are. But if you were to put that on your skin, it would cause very severe irritation. And to see children that have clearly heavy metal poisoning, that have started to lose hair and things like that, is quite striking. And it's going to motivate kind of everything I do for the near future.
So how are you working to keep acid from mines away from the water supply? What are some of the things you're working on?
So really we're looking at, because the problem is so big, is what are really low-cost solutions that we can apply in a massive scale? And many mines are from coal-fired power production. So as we burn coal, you get smoke that comes off. If you collect this smoke, we call it fly ash. Fly ash has a relatively high pH. So if we mix that or we put that back in the mines, then it neutralizes the mine water, which keeps the heavy metals from going into solution. And it also, if we can fill that mines back up with the waste material, then it keeps the air out of the mines, so it stops generating that acid mine drainage. And so real simple things, like let's take waste material that we were putting in a landfill over here, and let's put it back in these abandoned mines. And you think, oh, that's very simple. Then we've got to look politically. So you've got to allow the government to move one waste material to another. But it works quite well.
Well, what are the political challenges?
Well, the political challenges are you've got landfills and you've got abandoned mines. And those abandoned mines are owned by the government. And you have, especially in South Africa, the power company is a semi-governmental agency. And trying to get two governmental agencies to talk together is hard in South Africa as it is in the United States.
Well, did you have any big breakthroughs?
The breakthroughs are, we expected this to work pretty well, and it works. We're able to neutralize the mine water at about half the dosage of fly ash as we had originally thought, which means we can effectively do twice as much good.
That's cool. Are there concerns that you have going forward, things that, you know, you realize that the chemical process itself works more efficiently, it sounds like, than you had anticipated? Any realizations on the other end, things that are going to be challenges that maybe you hadn't foreseen?
Challenges are long-term performance. So it's very easy to run a test in the lab for a week or 2 weeks. But what happens after 6 months or a year or 2 years? And so fortunately, we've got a couple experiments set up in Cape Town, and we are running samples right now. So I've got my WhatsApp has been kind of blowing up from my guys in South Africa that are in the lab doing research. So I'm still in contact with them, and we're running some long-term tests.
Did you learn anything through this whole experience of going to Cape Town this summer and driving across South Africa with a refugee who's going to be coming and studying with you? But did you learn anything that's going to come back here with you to the classroom, whether it's a principle in engineering or something more philosophical?
So I would say more philosophical, that we learned that people are the same everywhere you go. And so we have different opportunities, but if you jump in a car and go for a drive, you're on a road, you meet people at gas stations, you meet people at hotels, and we're not that different. And so if you come back and you realize, although it's 30 hours away and it's quite a haul to get there, it's very much the same people, and those are people that we need to help. And so I can bring that back to the classroom. We can bring some pictures. Our large freshman class that we teach in the fall we'll have some water treatment. The students will actually be doing water treatment, so we'll give them some dirty water and make them think about how to treat water, because many of them have always turned the tap on and have never thought, what happens if I had to treat my own water?
Is it hard to get, especially like people at the beginning of their engineering careers, to think not just about materials and mechanics and chemistry and gravity and all the things that involve materials? Is it hard to remember that it's ultimately about people?
Generally, no. Engineers, as a rule, become engineers, or people lean towards engineering because they look at everyday life and think, I can do that better, or I can do that differently. And so inherently, we are connected to technology, we are connected to society. And so all we have to do is really tune that up, really bring that out in the students.
John Kevern, thank you so much.
Thank you much, Gina.
John chairs the Department of Civil and Mechanical Engineering at UMKC School of Engineering, and he spent the summer in Cape Town, South Africa. Up next, it's the game show that tests people's knowledge by making them come up with questions that match certain answers. What is Jeopardy? I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is Alex Trebek.
Here we go. Now the categories, starting off with the school year. How appropriate.
Last spring, Alex asked the three contestants in the annual Teachers Tournament this question, or I guess answer, in Final Jeopardy.
230 miles long, it defined a boundary between a colony founded by Quakers and one founded by Catholics. You have 30 seconds. Good luck.
Do you know what it is?
What is the Mason-Dixon line?
Larry Martin was one of the teachers on that stage, and he obviously did know. He is with me now. So, Larry, remind us what you wrote on that. You have to write it. You don't get to buzz on Final Jeopardy.
You have to write it. And they let you put it in the form of a question first.
So what is the Mason-Dixon line?
It is the line that divides the North and South, basically.
So with that, you won the Teachers Tournament on freaking Jeopardy.
It was a big deal for me.
Was this a long-standing dream of yours? I hear that you have been trying to get on Jeopardy for a really long time.
17 or 18 years, I think. And I've traveled to St. Louis and Chicago and Oklahoma City to be in auditions also.
Many times over many years?
Yes.
What is it about Jeopardy that has always called to you in this way?
I think it works like my mind works. My knowledge is about an inch deep, but it's very, very broad. Lots of topics that I know a little bit about, and that's what Jeopardy hits. General knowledge, not just trivia.
So how does it work, first getting on the show and then being on the show?
Well, I got a phone call, and by chance, I got a phone call that the phone wasn't supposed to ring in my classroom during the school day, but it did. And it was Larry, yes. This is Karina Nusha from Jeopardy. And for about 15 minutes, it didn't really matter to me very much what the students were doing in the classroom. Because I realized the dream was about to happen, and they asked me to be on the show. That was in late January. And we recorded the episodes on March 20th and 21st in Los Angeles.
So but before that, all these auditions, how do those work?
Very first, you take an online test that's given live so that no one can compare answers, of course. And if you do well on that, you might get an email saying, we'd like for you to come to one of these regional auditions, and you can pick a place that's fairly close to you, possibly. And then they give you another 50-question questionnaire that happens very quickly. And you play a mock game, and they do a mock interview, which is an important thing because they want to see that people are personable, too. They don't lay that on too thick, but they want you to be someone that seems happy to be there.
So You, our listeners can't see you. You have a distinctive mustache, I would say. Do you think that helped?
I think the fact that I drew the mustache and eyebrows on my answer, like I always draw it on notes to my students, I think Alex really liked that. You can actually see Alex and me talking about our mustaches as he walks by.
But so you teach second grade. I want to,
yes.
I'll get back to Jeopardy, but you teach second grade.
Yes.
And
for 28 years now.
Do you think the mustache, it sounds like you incorporate the mustache into your teaching. Do you think that having a gimmick is helpful? I'm sorry to call it a gimmick.
That's okay.
It's a nice mustache.
Of course. Thank you very much. That's just me, though. when we had watch parties at school, the teachers who did an incredible job arranging the watch parties, wonderful people. One of the things they did was put mustaches up all around the school, and it was very surreal to see that.
Okay, we're going to get back to the watch party, but part of the whole watch party deal is that you couldn't tell people. You knew you won before you could tell anyone.
Right.
Was that hard?
It was incredibly hard. I knew it for 7 weeks, and it was kind of fun. But, the only real problem was a lot of people thought, why is he so interested to make sure we watch if he didn't win? He must have done well. But no one knew for sure except for my wife, Rebecca, and me.
So that winning moment, can you take me back to that moment a little bit? We heard it, but take us back to that moment in terms of what it felt like for you.
Well, the getting Final Jeopardy right that time turned out not quite to matter because I found out in the seconds before the question, since it's a two-day cumulative points, it's not quite so obvious to know what your score is compared to others. It was only in the seconds before that I realized I didn't have to bid anything because I had what they call a lockout. If my nearest competitor, Claire, who is a wonderful player and a wonderful person, if she bid everything, she still couldn't quite catch me. When I realized that after doing the math three different times in two different ways just to try to convince myself, I did feel just slightly dizzy and my knees felt a little loose.
The teacher's contest works a little differently from regular Jeopardy, right?
Yes. The game is exactly the same, but it's a two-week, it shows in 2 weeks. It's filmed over 2 days, and starting with 15 players, all of whom are teachers. And again, that was the nicest group of people. I was so proud to be part of the profession that got this many different teachers, a very different, you know, all of teaching all grades and all subjects. They were an excellent group of players, but also just genuinely nice people.
But how it works for teachers participating in the teachers tournament is different from how it works. I mean, just the logistics of the process and also what's at stake,
right.
the winnings are.
The fact that it's a tournament rather than if you win, you go on and continue to play other games until you lose. The 15 teachers get whittled down over 2 weeks to three teachers in the final.
And then each of those three teachers goes into it knowing that they're going to come back with something, right?
Yes. We start all knowing we'll have $5,000, $10,000 if you make the semifinals. And then if you make it into the finals, third place is $25,000, second place is $50,000, and first place is $100,000.
And so as the winner, you've brought back serious winnings.
Yes.
What are you going to do with that?
Well, you know, it's not a lottery winning, complete life change sort of thing. So I thought it's more fun to have several little pleasures from it. The two things that I have done that have taken a little chunk of it so far are to pay my daughter's very last tuition check to KU, very last one, and a very major upgrade of my bicycle.
Are you a big biker?
I'm not a very serious one, but I really enjoy it. And my Bianchi bicycle, I tried to just upgrade it, but we ended up almost replacing everything on it.
But you bring funds back to the classroom, too.
Which reminds me, yes, I park that bicycle in the classroom every day.
But the this will allow you to do some things in the classroom.
Yes.
Each teacher brings back a certain amount that is dedicated
to
the classroom.
That's a separate check that all of us get from Farmers Insurance, Thank America's Teachers Program, $2,500 to use for some special project for our classroom. And mine is to expand my class newspaper, the Marvel News, to reach out to get it more online and maybe a small video aspect.
So tell me more about Marvel News. This is a long project of yours, and it
yes.
has quite a history. And I want you to take us back to the beginning and tell us about it.
Thank you. Well, most of the years I've taught, we've had the Marvel News. This will be our 24th year coming up. It's a four-page newspaper. We're Martin's Marvels, and that's why the students voted that first year we decided to have the newspaper, voted to name it the Marvel News. The Marvel News, the students do almost every aspect of it. They come up with the story ideas. They interview people. They write their own stories. They edit it together. They make puzzles and games and comic strips. They sell it. They advertise it. They sell subscriptions to it. And over the years, we've had a number of major interviews, such as President Obama, David Beckham, Bill Gates, Barbara Bush. I really could go on for quite a while.
It's quite a list. How did you get the idea to start a second grade class newspaper and to set your ambitions that high, to go and get interviews with people that professional journalists struggle to get interviews with?
Well, first of all, let me say something about that, getting the interviews we do. We have an advantage because even a high school newspaper, you know, the people who've given many, many interviews, they say, no, I'm not interested. But we have the cute factor on our side. They say, yes, you know, I will do that one for the second graders. But I just began it when I realized a newspaper touches on many, many different subjects. Basically, any you'd like to tackle. And so all of the kids will have roles they can play.
And so this has been going on, you said, 28 years?
No, I've taught for 28.
You've taught for 28 years.
This will be our 24th year of the Marvel News.
And what is it that that having some funding behind it will allow you to do with this publication?
To make it easier for people to access it online and to, like I say, to do maybe small amounts of video. We now have a few hundred subscribers in most years. The prices never change. It's only 10 cents an issue or a dollar for a subscription for 12 issues during the year.
So as you were winning Jeopardy,
yes.
were you thinking about some of these things that you were going to do? Or was it just, were you totally in the moment? Because this is a goal that you've had for such a long time, to be not just be on Jeopardy, but then at that point, the goal becomes obviously to win Jeopardy.
Well, it was tying together frighteningly well. I think that it really helped me to get on the show that I had these interesting stories to tell about the newspaper and also about a project that I always do. At the last day of school, I give each of the students a framed caricature of themselves that says, follow your dreams, you can make them come true.
I want to say something here.
Yes.
A caricature is often unflattering. Do second graders
I'm very gentle with
okay.
that.
Okay, go on.
Each of them have told me some things they hope to do someday. So each of them, it's showing them doing that thing. And when I told Alex Trebek about that, he said, oh, maybe you should do one of me. And I said, I'd love to. Jeopardy contacted me a couple weeks later and asked me if I would like to do it. And so Alex loves home repairs, so his caricature shows him having remodeled the entire Jeopardy set by hand, and they put that caricature right up on their websites.
So you must have some pretty interesting heart-to-hearts with second graders that they are sharing with you their fantasies of what they would like to be doing. Or...
My favorite... was about 3 years ago, I got an email that showed two photos, one of me saying, follow your dreams, Danny, you can make them come true, with him being a doctor. And on the other side of it was a photo of his medical school diploma.
Wow. Do you, when What is it that you would consider to be kind of your guiding? Do you have a guiding principle that inspires you as a second grade teacher?
To try to instill that very point, follow your dreams, you can make them come true.
Was your dream to be a teacher?
It was one of them. Another one was to be on Jeopardy.
Oh my gosh. So the dream to be on Jeopardy coming true, what are you going to do with yourself now? Do you need a new
hobby? I don't have
to
give it up. Not yet, because when you win the teacher's tournament, you get an automatic invitation to the Jeopardy Tournament of Champions. So sometime in the next year, I'll be back on stage.
When you, which brings us back to, you couldn't tell your students, I mean, your wife
no
was with you.
No one but my wife.
But no one else knew.
Right.
You were about to win a lot of money and you had to keep it secret for 7 weeks. But not
That's
only
true.
That, you just lived out your life dream.
Exactly. So several teachers did say, I had a feeling because you had such a smile on your face when you were mentioning it.
Did you... So going into this watch party, it was not just that all these people were going to see you win, but you could finally celebrate.
Right. And there were four watch parties, one for each of the four games over the period of the 2 weeks.
And these were watch parties in the school gymnasium,
It was perfect timing because Shawnee Mission Schools end their day at 3:10 and the show airs here at 3:30. So perfect timing for people to come gather.
Tell me about those watch parties and especially the last one.
Well, one of the many wonderful surprises they had, along with mustaches for everyone to wear and T-shirts that for everyone, all the teachers to say who is Belinda's favorite Jeopardy player, and then back it said who is Mr. Martin, was when I won, they actually fired off confetti cannons. I never expected to have confetti cannons. I also never expected to be able to get a giant novelty check, which I got from Farmers Insurance on the first watch party.
What was it? Is it special to get a giant novelty check? I can't even imagine myself in that situation.
It was, again, a little bit surreal. It was like a comically satisfying moment.
Do you, I mean, I watched a video of that watch party in that moment, and the applause goes on and on and on and gets louder and louder for almost a weirdly long time. What did that feel like to you?
There are basically two of the high points of my life are winning the Jeopardy tournament and being able to experience those watch parties at Belinda.
Do you, as you get ready for your next school year as a teacher's tournament Jeopardy champion, What's top of mind? What are your big plans?
Every year we have a time capsule of things that the kids do in the first couple of weeks of school. We lock it away and open it at the last of the year. But at the end of last year, I had another discovery, which is that a 30-year time capsule from Belinda had been lost, and I discovered it. It was 2 years late. It was supposed to be open in 30 years. So we got to share what was in it last year.
What was in it?
The most interesting thing was a copy of the Kansas City Times, but also a list of everyone who was in the school at that time, including all the students' names, and one of the students is now a teacher at Belinda. It was a great thrill to see his name on there.
And so
we're
getting ready to start the burial process with
your first. We're going to bury a new one for 30 years.
For 30 years. Yes. So what are your thoughts about what you should put in something that is going to be an exciting discovery 30 years from now, or perhaps 32 years from now?
The first thing someone said was to put in a fidget spinner. But I had person after person say, be sure to put something about winning Jeopardy.
Are you going to?
Yes.
What is it going to be?
Oh, it'll be small. I don't know. I don't want to overdo it. Although I did buy a model of the Trojan horse because that was one of the other final Jeopardy answers I got right. I thought that would be a nice thing to put in the classroom.
Can I give you an idea for your time capsule?
Oh, please, yes.
You could take one of the, like, mustache things that the kids brought to the watch party and put that in there.
I'm flattered. I like that idea. Thank
you. Well, Larry Martin, with us from Belinda Elementary, congratulations on your big Jeopardy win.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Mr. Martin teaches second grade, and our time is up. But you can listen back to any of the What I Did This Summer stories on today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. Talk to us on Twitter anytime. We're at KCURCST, and we want to know what's on your mind, what you think we should be talking about. At KCURCST. Tomorrow, movie theaters mean more than entertainment in small towns and rural communities. We'll be talking about what that is tomorrow at 10. Join the discussion. Today's show was produced by Suzanne Hogan with help from intern Trevor Hook. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.